This is a speaker meeting, and Megan will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Chris, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. And I'd like to turn the meeting over to Megan. I'm going to turn this guy on for you. Just clip him on to your lapel somewhere. Not lapel, but...
It's heavily.
Near the chestal region.
Oh.
There you go.
Hi, I'm Megan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Megan.
I'm really nervous tonight. I'm usually not nervous to speak, but I happen to listen to this podcast on my commute quite often, and I know, like, the next time I'm not paying attention, I'm going to accidentally turn myself on and, like, run off the road. No, hopefully not, but it brings me a lot of comfort to hear that, so hopefully I can be of service to not only you guys in the room here tonight, but anyone else who ends up listening. Let's see, I have a sobriety date of November 5th, 2015, so I'm 16 months. I have a sponsor. Yeah, 16 months used to seem like so long to me, and now it doesn't seem like long at all. I know I have a long road of me in recovery, and I'm grateful for that. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I work the steps. I work the steps because if I don't, I'm going to die, and I will cause even more pain to my loved ones than I already have. When I came into the rooms, I'm not sure if I qualified for the third tradition because I only had the desire to stop drinking on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. I was only under court order to undergo random drug and alcohol testing, which happened once a week. So the earliest I could test on any given week was Monday morning. The ETG went back 96 hours. That meant I could drink until Thursday night at midnight. So if I got called in on Friday, that sucked because I couldn't drink for like a whole week. But I didn't know what to do with myself when I wasn't drinking. I'll go back in time a little bit. I mean, it's a lot of blah, blah, blah until it really accelerated. I was in an abusive marriage, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. That's not what makes me an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I like the effects. Let's see, I had a son. Luckily for me, I think what kept me alive for a long time is I never liked the taste of alcohol. Right before, I don't know, a year before I got pregnant, I found white wine. Sorry, I don't know why, white wine. And that I liked. I never wanted a glass of white wine, I wanted at least a bottle. Two bottles, preferably. Let's see. So I sobered up, quote unquote. I was dry throughout my pregnancy, which is a blessing. And then when my son was about 9 months old, two things happened. I stopped breastfeeding, and he started sleeping through the night. So I was off to the races. I put him in bed, 8 p.m., 8:01. I was popping a bottle open, and I was gone until the next morning. I thought this was totally fine. I saw zero problem with that because my son wasn't seeing me drinking or drunk. No worries, right? It didn't matter that I didn't hear him when he cried in the middle of the night. I didn't think about that. Let's see. I eventually filed for divorce from my husband. A week later, he sued for full custody, which shocked me completely. I was so shocked. There was an ex parte, which means a court shortening order, which means the judge wants to see you like ASAP. Went in, and my husband had photos of like empty bottles in a trash can and all the empty bottles that I used to hide in the trunk of my car because I knew he was watching me. That made sense, right? It didn't. I was insane. This was all insanity. The judge believed him, which he should have. I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe it myself. And they took away overnights with my kid. I saw him 4 days a week for 2 hours a day. My son was four, and I saw him on Saturdays for 5 hours. And then I was ordered to go undergo drug and alcohol counseling. Sent me in a huge pile of self-pity. Huge. and anger and resentment. And even not seeing, like, I mean, I would be like, they took my four-year-old away from me. The judge, that ex-husband, it's all his fault. It's all their fault. And the consequence of not getting to read bedtime stories with my son, which I love and always have, wasn't enough for me. So, you know, I was undergoing the drug and alcohol testing, and, you know, if I got a positive test, that would mean losing full custody. That wasn't enough for me. Like I said, I would drink as soon as, or the beginning of the week, as soon as I got that call, hopefully it was on a Monday morning, went straight to the bar to celebrate, stopped at Thursday midnight. Thanks. I saw zero problem with this. I didn't think that was even breaking the law. I was insane. I mean, I was like, I'm passing my alcohol tests. I'm doing exactly what the court wants me to do. Saw zero problem. One Saturday night, I did drink. I'm not sure if it was self-sabotage. I knew exactly what I was doing. I did know in the back of my head what was at stake. And I happened to get called in that Monday morning. Alcohol test goes back 96 hours. So I purposefully diluted my test. I drank a lot of water. I was very well hydrated. Very insane. And the test came out as dilute. And court counts that as positive. I didn't happen to lose all custody because I guess a positive would have been worse. But I lost more. So angry. That wasn't enough. I lived in terror and fear every day for almost a year doing this alcohol testing. Will they call me in? Will they call me in? Is the 96 hours going to work? It was awful. At the very end, I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I was terrified. I was alone. I didn't tell anybody this. I was so ashamed. Still, every night when I take my inventory, my fear always, I'm a bad mom. Always. I still have a lot of guilt and shame. But I'm working on it. And this program, I mean, while I still have a lot of guilt and shame, I'm happier than I've ever been in my entire life. And it's a gift. It's such a gift. So when I came into these rooms, right, I just really wanted help not drinking that Friday, Saturday, Sunday night. But when I came in, I caught alcoholism. Like, it wasn't the first meeting I went to because I cried all the way through that one, but it was the preamble during the second meeting. Those who are incapable of being honest with themselves. So I was so dishonest with myself. I was so dishonest with myself, I didn't even know it. I still didn't stop drinking. Eventually I did because I wanted to fit in. Character defect that worked until it didn't. Nope, that's still going. But I was still smoking pot. Didn't see any problem with that. But that phrase, those who are incapable of being honest with themselves, it got to me, it really got to me. And I had eventually my first spiritual experience while high. I think I did. I have spiritual experiences that are much better, but I swear I had one of those moments where God spoke to me. I was really high. I was about to meet my sponsor, and I knew I couldn't. Hi, Danica. She was my sponsor. And like God spoke to me and he said, Megan, it's time. It's time. And that was November 4th, 2015. And that's my sobriety date. I have it tattooed on my wrist. Not because it's permanent. I hope it is. I pray it is. But we're alcoholics. We could relapse any time. I know I have to work my program every single day to stay sober. Every single morning, I wake up, and the first thing I do is pray. I mean, when I started working the program, I started working the program. Finally, I had the gift of desperation. Finally. So I wake up every morning, and I pray. I do the Serenity Prayer. I do third-step prayer. I do seventh-step prayer. I do St. Francis Prayer. I meditate. I read pages 86 through 88. I ask God to help me walk through the day as a sober woman of dignity and grace. I want to be the woman that God meant for me to be. I heard the only step you can skip to is step 11, establishing conscious contact with your higher power. And I did skip to 11. I've been through 12. I'm back on 1. Oh, man, it's funny going through it the second time. I mean, I thought, obviously, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Step work is hard. Anyhow, life is better. I have my son back. I still have a job. I have a place to live. I have a car. I'm lucky. But the thing is even more than that, like getting the gifts, right? What is it? Cash and prizes, right? My son's the big one. To get sober, I had to put my sobriety first. And that meant even before my son. And that was really hard for me to get. And now I know, even if I did lose custody of my son, or he died, or whatever happened, because I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I only have today. If I stay sober, everything will be okay. He's the highlight. He's the joy of my life, and I always loved him. But that happiness, joyousness, and freedom, my son said, we do a gratitude list every night. And he said the other day, thanks God for making me joyous today. And I was like, who is this kid? He's 6. It's my baby. Anyways, but I put my program before everything, because anything I put before my sobriety, I stand to lose. And then I really do lose everything. Thanks so much for asking me to speak.
Put it in the chestal area.
So my name is I have to concentrate on not, you know, I always introduce myself by my last name because we're anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film, but because I practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all my affairs, and you know, I also practice some of those principles are principles of the tradition. So my name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Berkeley. Emeryville, Oakland. I'm not sure exactly where we are.
No one knows.
My name is Chris. My sobriety date is November 7th of 2005. The Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous in San Jose, California is my home group. Welcome to the people from Sonoma County. I'm actually originally from Mendocino. That's where I was born and raised. And started my running amok. I was a late bloomer. Well, to really running amok. The first time I drank, I blacked out and threw up, wet myself. And, you know, I can't say, like, I discovered whatever the bright shining light of alcohol, because I have no recollection of what I discovered, you know. Other than that, you know, that I could be a real mess. But it wasn't long before I, you know, continued making that mess. You know, I don't have that story like I always felt weird. I did feel weird and different, but I didn't feel, I didn't feel like it was a bad thing. You know, my parents were hippies and teachers and supportive of weirdness and differenceness. And so I was encouraged and fostered in my weirdness, you know, and encouraged to be unique and different. And so I never suffered behind it. You know, I didn't have a hard time making friends. You know, I didn't we kind of lived out of town, and you know, my parents were teachers. My grandmother was a reading teacher for our whole town. My mom taught me to read when I was two. We had shelves full of books. I just read, you know, I read. And but even then, when I, you know, got into school, I mean, it wasn't hard to make friends, and I had a lot of fun. You know, but kind of the thing, you know, in third grade, they give, like, those achievement tests, you know, to kind of see where you're at with stuff. And so, like, in third grade, I tested at a 12th grade reading level and math, you know. And so in third grade, I'm looking at my teachers going, well, what's the point of coming back here? You know, what am I going to do? What are you guys going to do with me for the next 8 years? And so I was kind of a punk. You know, also in third grade, I read this book called Atlas Shrugged, which, you know, I don't know if you're, you know, like, I mean, and so, and I bought in, you know, I bought in. I was a unique individualist, and the common masses were there to prevent me from achieving my utmost greatness. And, you know, so yeah, weird, unique, different, and I didn't think it was a bad thing. You know, I enjoyed alcohol. You know, I didn't feel like I came from a weird family. I mean, now that I'm older and I've done more work, I'm aware of my family's quirks and deficiencies. But it felt like a warm place to be. You know, like there was a lot of hugs in my house. I was told I love you, you're great. You know, you can be anything you want to be. A lot of hugs, you know, a lot of hugs, a lot of my love yous, you know. But then, you know, we would go see my grandmother, my mom's mom, and I'd be, I love you, Grandma. And she'd say, actions speak louder than words. And I'd be, oh, that hurts my feelings, you know. I didn't know what she meant. When I give, like, a regular topic discussion talk, that's always my topic, 100% of the time. Actions speak louder than words. Learning that has given me a life worth living. You know, it saved my life from being the life that it was. You know, when I drink Jack Daniels and smoke methamphetamine, I go to work almost every day. I pay all my bills. I have good credit. I live in a nice place. I have nice stuff. I drive a nice car. And I have a hot chick. And I'm dying inside. Because I don't have a disease of circumstances. You know, I've come to the conclusion that the spiritual malady of which I suffer is that I spend all day thinking about how I feel and how I'd rather feel. And that separates me from the 7 billion other humans who are not spending all day thinking about how I'd rather feel. And that produces a crushing, aching loneliness. I was not alone. You know, I had the love of my family who wanted more FaceTime with me. You know, I had a woman at home. You know, I had the respect and admiration of my coworkers and bosses. I couldn't really tell. I couldn't feel it, but they would express it. But I couldn't feel it. And the loneliest place on earth is when I would come home from the bar each night and take my woman in my arms. You know, because she just didn't understand. My friend Keith says that's the battle cry of the alcoholic. You just don't understand. You just don't understand that my feelings are the most important thing on the planet. You know, it's a painful place to be. If you're in this room tonight and you're suffering, you know, from what it talks about in our doctor's opinion as an internal spiritual maladjustment. Says we're maladjusted to life. If you're suffering tonight because, you know, because of them or her or him or that or, you know, or if you're afraid, you feel alone, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the place where it doesn't have to get worse and it can get better. When I took my second trip to rehab, I was completely without hope. You know, my dad told me, Chris, you get your stuff together. He didn't use that word. you get your stuff together and everything will be okay. So I got my stuff together. I wasn't even on the same planet as okay. You know, the Big Book talks about it. It describes it as the awful ache of a loneliness so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that it seemed nothing and no one could ever touch it. That's strong language. Bill Wilson uses a lot of flowery lingo, you know, but you know when he uses words like that, you know that he knew what he was talking about. You know, when I was in treatment and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous would come in and give talks to us, it was the fact that these people who clearly didn't feel like I was feeling, because you could see, like, because they glowed, right? They glowed. I mean, to me, they looked like people in magazines, supermodels, you know? Figures of vigor and fitness and glowing vitality and love and life. And then they would talk about the pain and the confusion and the fear and the loneliness, you know? And this one girl came in and talked, and she didn't talk about the insanity of doing the same thing except expecting different results. She talked about knowing that it was a bad idea. This is a bad idea, and doing it anyway. That was the nature of mine. That's what I related. I was like, whoa, because that's where I was at. I had come up with the idea, the notion that my fiance was hypnotizing me in my sleep. That's why I kept going to the bar. You know? Because my circumstances weren't unmanageable. I'm a thoroughly competent man. I get the things I set out to get. I do the things I set out to do. When I want to make something happen, I make it happen. I can do everything I want to do except this one thing. I keep failing. It's Monday, don't go to the bar. It's Tuesday, don't go to the bar. People don't go to the bar on Tuesdays. It's Wednesday, don't go to the bar. It's Thursday, don't go to the bar. I only go to the bar on days that end in Y. I was at the bar every day. You know, your Tinica's sister was my bartender. And I mean, I was there every day, and it was just, I put a sign on the inside of my front door. It said, "Chris, don't go to the bar. You're just trying to amuse yourself. It's not working. You're just not that kind of person." Right? So when I was in treatment, and the AA members came in and they said, "Chris," they didn't actually say Chris, they were talking to all of us, but I'm selfish and self-centered, so, you know, whoever's talking, I feel like they're talking to me. They said, "Chris, you're not drinking and using to have a good time." And this, I was like, yeah. They said, "You're drinking and using for relief." And I was like, "Whoa." All the amazing thousands, literally thousands of hours that I've spent thinking about this, because, you know, I like to mix methamphetamine with my Jack Daniels, right? So there wasn't a lot of sleeping. There was a lot of time for thinking. You know, and so my thinking was that I was being hypnotized, right? Not that I was needing relief. And so to hear this, like, I needed relief. Like, I didn't want relief. Like, I didn't have a slight desire for relief. I had an aching, screaming need for relief. And what I thought at the time, at the first immediate time that I understood this, what I first thought I needed relief from was my problems. Was her and them and the bills and the bank, you know, and the fact that, like, you know, I'm making around 100 grand a year, but I always run out of money just a few days before payday, you know? And the reason why I was in treatment was not because I thought getting sober was a great idea. You know, I had to operate a company vehicle as a condition of employment. And I got a DUI on my 36th birthday. And so I lost my privilege to operate a motor vehicle, right? And I knew that, I knew a couple of things. I knew that if I didn't have to keep it together enough to make it to work every day for a month, that somebody was going to die. I didn't know if it was going to be me or an innocent third party, you know, or a few of the second parties that I had screaming grudges against. But I knew somebody, something bad was going to happen if I didn't have to control it. Because it says, you know, the great obsession of every alcoholic is to control and enjoy their drinking. I could usually do one or the other. You know, I would get to the bar and I would enjoy it for about an hour and a half, and then I would control it for about 5.5 hours, and then I would enjoy it for like the last hour of the night. But if I didn't have to, if there were no rules or expectations, if I didn't have to keep it together, I knew that it would go right off the rails. So that was a motivation for trying something different. I knew from a previous stint, I wouldn't say attempt at rehab because that would be inaccurate, but a previous trip, that if you're in a residential treatment facility, you get, you're on state disability. And the way it worked with my company is I got full pay. I was making around $100,000 a year, but I was living paycheck to paycheck, you know? So I needed the money to keep coming in. So these were my reasons for checking myself into treatment. But while I was there, you know, the AA people came in and they said this, you know, that I wasn't drinking and using to have a good time, I was drinking and using for relief. They said something else. They said, Chris, they didn't actually say Chris, but what I heard was, Chris, the only difference between me and you is 12 steps. I'm like, what does that mean? That is ridiculous. Because like I said, these people, you know, they had that, they glowed. I mean, really, they had a perfect peace. The book talks about the perfect peace at ease, right? That only comes at once with a few drinks. But these people had it. And the people that I was seeing with a few, they were not getting perfect peace at ease from a few drinks. You know, they, like me, it wasn't quite working. You know, they were at the bar looking for something they weren't getting. They were in the bag looking for something they weren't getting, just like me. And then here were the people who obviously were getting what we'd all been looking for. And they said, all you have to do to get it is what we do. It made no sense whatsoever. Because I could see the steps. You know, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I did that every night, all night long when I was on speed, right? Just sit around and think about what a piece of crap I am. You know? Made direct demands to such people wherever possible. Screw that. You know, I was the one obsessed with it talks about in the book, you know, it says that it is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, right? The people who have done us more harm than we have done them. You know, I was a good guy. I was a good guy. I care about people. I'm here to help. I'm supportive. I'm encouraging. I say nice things. You know, so it didn't make any sense that this would produce the effect that these people were demonstrating, just walking around, being themselves, having that glow. But, you know, but after the fog started to clear, I would hear people talk in the little group therapy sessions, and I could hear how completely full of crap they were. But I realized that, and I would call them on it. I'm like, oh, you're full, totally full of crap. And then I said something, and some guy called me out, and I was like, damn. He got me. Totally right. Totally dead to rights. These people are completely full of crap, and I'm just like them. You know, and then I started getting all spiritual again, you know. I was saying all kinds of spiritual, oh, I can feel God in you, and oh, I hear God, oh, we're just all God with skin on, and I'm feeling all kinds of spiritual, right? And all of a sudden I have this moment of clarity, right, that on my previous trip to rehab where I was there for 3 weeks and whatever, got out, broke out in the middle of the night one time and stole my car and drove it back to San Jose, and then ended up back there, and they tested me. They're like, nobody ever breaks out of here and doesn't get loaded. Why did you do that? I'm like, well, you know, I was going to be different. And But I got out of there after 3 weeks. I checked myself into an SLE. I was there for 6 days. Then I got six of the people I was in rehab with loaded. You know, a lot of them young kids, you know, whose parents had paid cash. You know, like $15,000 cash for their child to go to treatment. And I got their kid loaded. You know, I didn't hold them down, but still. You know, and so what I was remembering now, 6 years later, in treatment again, saying all the spiritual stuff, the reality, because what I remembered is that I just didn't want what they had. And I just, whatever, I just got out of there, and then I went over there, and I got out of there, and then I just repped and run. But what I, the truth, like, showed up in my brain, that I had said all the exact same things before. That what I remembered about my first trip was inaccurate. That I hadn't just been given a lip service. That when I was there before, I had really felt it. I had really, truly felt spiritual. I had truly felt spiritually connected. I felt the deep wisdom in the heart of the program, and I completely turned my back on it. And at that moment, I was afraid. You know, because the things that happened immediately after getting out of there and getting those kids loaded, like, the dramatic horror of the things that happened, and then walking around with those things, the knowledge of those things for the next 6 years, was so like, to know that I could walk out of that place and have my life be like that again, only worse, was unimaginable. Because the other thing that had happened in there is that even though I had gotten there with no hope that anything would get better, like, the reason I was managing my life, the reason I was paying all those bills, the reason that I was, you know, driving the car, the reason that I was keeping the roof over our head, the reason I was doing all this stuff was because I knew it was going to get worse, but I didn't want it to get worse today. I was just trying to postpone the inevitable getting worse. I know it's going to get worse, you know, like, I'd be hanging out in the bar saying, oh man, you know, how's it going? Oh, it's going pretty good. Well, you know, don't ever say, you know, don't ever say how bad could it get. Don't do that. You know, and I just didn't want it to get worse right then. But I had no hope that it would ever get better. And then here in treatment, talking spiritual, seeing the AA people, seeing these different things, like, the door opened, just the tiniest little crack and a little bit of hope shined through. Just a little bit. I didn't think that I was going to be glowing or look like the supermodel people, but I thought maybe, just maybe, a little bit of okay. Just a little bit of okay was out there for me. And so the fear that I had been in that place before of spiritual connection and a little bit of hope and had squandered it, the fear of doing that a second time was in me. So I read they had literature, you know, it said, you know, they had an AA pamphlet on sponsorship. So I'm like, what's a sponsor, right? You read that pamphlet, it's full of things a sponsor is not. Sponsor's not a bank. Sponsor's not Uber. You know, sponsor's not an ATM. Sponsor's not, you know, an employment agency. Although it says in our book that at times, in the right situation, a sponsor can be those things. But a sponsor is not those things. And finally, you get towards the end, and it says that what a sponsor is someone to take you through the 12 steps of your recovery program the same way that they were taken through. You know, and so they took us to an outside meeting, and I listened to the meeting. At the end of the meeting, they said, you know, is there a burning desire? I hate that burning desire stuff, but I stood up, and I said, I was so antsy. The book calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. I call it edgy, right? And I was an edgy motherfucker, right? And on edge, I stood up, and I said, you know, I want what you guys have, and I'm willing to take direction. And a bunch of guys came up and, like, shook my hand and stuff. But one guy, like, walked outside, and we had our little interview, you know. My big question was, dude, like, do you have fun in recovery? And he just laughed at me. He's like, have you been having fun, bro? You know? yeah, I had been living my life in such a manner that, you know, on the 7th of November of 2005, the best possible decision I could have made was to check myself into a treatment facility. You know? Like, normal, if you're living, for most people, that's not one of the options they're considering. But if you're in a position where that's one of the options you're considering, it's a great option. You know? If that's where you're at and what you need, avail yourself of it. You know, it's a good place to be when the smoke clears. Because that's where I was able to hear and see, you know, what it was that I needed to see. So with that man, you know, I said, you know, hey, do you have any assignments for me? And this guy, like, he's not Mr. Rockstar AA sponsor. He had never sponsored anybody. His sponsor had been yelling at him to get a sponsee. And so here some new guy stands up. I'm willing to take direction. Well, all right. But he didn't know what any of the assignments were. It had been 3 years since he'd done any step work. So he's all, well, how are you with the God thing? Bro, me and God are cool. I'm so down with God. I'm really feeling the God thing. He goes, good. Then you won't mind making the commitment to get on your knees right before your, right next to your bed each night before you go to sleep and pray. I was all, oh. Oh. Dirty bastard, you know. And but I had another moment of clarity right then that I had gotten to the place where I was at right then by being full of crap. Right? And if I looked at that man in the eye and say, you know, yes, I'll do that, and then actually did it, that would be one thing. That would be one thing I could do to start myself on the road of not being full of crap. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And so that night I got on my knees, you know, and I was still hearing voices in my head, right? So I get my knees up, hear these voices in my head. Oh yeah, Chris likes it on his knees. Uh-huh. Oh yeah, Chris, you know. You know? And it was embarrassing and humiliating, and I did it anyway. Because I told that man I would. I gave him my word. You know? I told him that I would do that. And, you know, they, if you say here, like, all you have to change is everything, is one of those, like, hey, mumbo-jumbo sayings, you know? It's like, what the? You know, I when I did that, everything changed. You know, I've sponsored guys who not cool with the God idea at all. But if you want to take steps with me, I don't care what you believe in. You have to be willing to get on your knees and have a conversation with something. I don't care what it is. You have to be willing to get on your knees and have that conversation. You can't dictate terms to the planet from your knees. It doesn't work. That's what we do. We dictate terms. This is how it has to be. And then when it's not, we live in our heads, right? We develop this whole elaborate fantasy, right? Planet Chris, where everybody treats me right, and I always get the cool stuff, and she never says no, and, you know, and everything, and I always feel amazing. And then, so the only reason planet Earth sucks is because it doesn't look like planet Chris. But when I'm on my knees, I ask, you know, like, you know, I loved your prayer. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. My prayer is show me where and how to be useful. It gets answered all the time. It gets answered from the moment I leave house, like I'm in traffic. There's opportunities for usefulness in traffic. Don't be as big an asshole as the other people. You know, when I go to work, there's opportunities for usefulness all day at work. They brought me there because they have a need. Right, I'm not there to wrestle cash out of their hands. I'm there to meet a need, and to the best extent I'm able to do that, the better I'm rewarded on the back end. But it's not about that, because what I found here, like, all I wanted was to be happy. Right, all I wanted was to be happy. I would chase happiness so hard, and it would always get away. The loneliness is not caused by being alone. The loneliness is caused by thinking about how I'd rather feel. The Big Book says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon the constant thought of others and how we might best meet their needs. I have never been able to live up to that. The best I ever do is the intermittent thought of others. That's on my best day. But I'll tell you what, it has been sufficient for almost total relief for over 11 years. Because when I'm thinking about me, I feel like crap. That ache just gets bigger and bigger. The hole gets deeper and deeper. And the weirdest thing is when I think about you, like, how are you doing? What do you need? All of a sudden, when I'm not thinking about me, that ache just goes away. The more I think about the ache, the bigger it gets. I don't think about it. It's gone. It's like the magical paradox at the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of times for people, I see a lot of people nodding here. There's also a lot of glowing in this room. A lot of people here are doing the work and reaping the rewards. Not necessarily cash and prizes. I have gotten a prize out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's me. You know, when I wrapped up making my amends to my ex, I opened the conversation pretty early, but after I made changes and paid her back for all kinds of stuff, about 2.5 years into the thing, she said, Chris, you were always a guy with a lot of wisdom, but you could never follow through on anything. Nobody says that about me today. Sometimes I have people in my life that don't understand this thing or don't necessarily support it. And they're like, why do you do that? Why are you doing that? Somebody asked me, here I'm like, chilling, watching a movie. I'm going to get up, go out to the car, go to Oakland. You want to come? No, why are you going there? Like, because I said I would. Well, why would you say that you would? Well, because the way my life is, not by accident. I cannot acquire the quality of life that I have today. It's not something I could chase down and build. It's a side effect of being there for other people. Mm-hmm. With an open heart. Because when I'm there, I'm there for my loved ones, I'm there for my family, I'm there for my boss, my coworkers, I'm there for, significant others. But that's not 100% the same, right? Because that's being there for people who can be there for me in return. And so, I'm not so saintly that there's not an iota of self-interest involved in that. And sometimes it's not even being nice to people, it's being nice at them. Right? But when I'm working with a new man in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no profit motive. At least there wasn't at first. Because I had no hope that the first 40 guys I worked with got drunk. So when the first guy stayed sober, he celebrated 10 years on the 6th of this month. when the first guy stayed sober, it was very clear to me that it wasn't because I was a great sponsor. It's because he did the work. I have a flashlight. I will let you use it. But if you don't turn it on, you're going to be wandering around in the dark. I got a flashlight. I got lots of batteries. But you got to turn that thing on. I've always been a person to whom words come easily, but it's the way I live that makes my life worth living. It's the things I do. It's not what I say at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for an hour. It's the way I live the 23 hours a day I'm not in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Or 22 today, I I gave a talk earlier today, but it's the things that I do. You know, when I go into a meeting, you know, I kind of talk to the wallflowers instead of the cool people, you know? I just know, I see a need, right? That's my prayer. Show me where and how to be useful. And where I see a need, I try to be present. You know, it's stuff that's in the 11th step prayer, you know? But that's the fabric of my life. And no matter how pretty I might talk at times or how good my mouthpiece, words are not sufficient to talk about what my life is like on the inside as a result of the work that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. Words fail me to tell you how it feels to be Chris Ugrin. It's not always like tripping like fantastic through the daisies, but the thing is that I've been equipped to meet every challenge. I don't have any understanding of God, but I feel the love. Usually it shows up as challenges that I can't meet on my own. And so I have to reach out my heart and invite the power into my life and avail myself of that power and work with that power to meet those challenges. There are things that are too big for just me, but there's nothing I found that's too big for me and whatever that is. You know, I use the word God because the big book says that we use common everyday language to express spiritual things, you know? And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my life. It's an amazing life. You know, I lost everything I got sober to keep in sobriety. 4 years ago, I was living on $175 a week, you know, had an $800 motorcycle, didn't have a car. 2 years ago, I bought a home in San Jose, you know, in a desirable neighborhood, one of the most expensive markets there is, you know. I have a job that teaches me amazing things, and I get to be a part of amazing things. I'm working at Intel, building amazing stuff. Not for Intel, but, you know, I'm in construction, and we build amazing, huge things that do wild and crazy stuff that I'm learning to understand. I work 60 hours a week. I go to school 4 nights a week to learn about my job. And I'm fascinated and excited and challenged, and I love what my life is about. You know, it's full of opportunity. It's full of excitement, and I'm full of gratitude. And I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Chris.